Hello, Jamel.
Hello.
This is Con Carroll filling in for Bill Schur on This Week in Blog, and we have with us a new staff writer for the American Prospect filling in for the lefty side of the blog this week. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
All right. My name is Jamel Bowie. I am the new writing fellow for the American Prospect, not quite a staff writer. I'm new. I just started a few months ago, and I'm glad to be here doing this on Blogging Heads. It's my first.
Cool. Where were you before you joined Team Tapped?
I was working for the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. And before that, I was in college. So I'm still very new to the whole writing game.
Ah, so were you a UVA undergraduate as well?
Yes.
Gotcha. So not a long ride up 95 from Charlottesville to Washington D.C. for you.
Not at all.
Okay, great. Well, let's go ahead and start off with our first topic. We want to talk about the Kentucky Center race. Jack Conway versus Rand Paul, and Jack Conway had a kind of a Hail Mary pass ad out. I think it started out over the weekend, and this was a ad based pretty much entirely off of a the Aqua Buddha story that ran in what, Rolling Stone or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was Rolling Stone.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, and if we're wrong, trust me, the commenters will correct us. But anyway, so the woman has since recanted the story. But Conway went with it anyways, and you saw quite a pretty fascinating divergence on the left of opinion on this ad. You had the New Republic types, the Jonathan Chaits, found the most despicable ad of the season. Then you had kind of the more hardcore leftist apologists, the partisans, the Daily Coasters, and the Matt Iglesias, saying there's nothing wrong with the ad. So as a person of the left, I'll go ahead and ask you what you thought of it.
Well, I mean, first, I don't think I'd go as far as to call the ad a Hail Mary pass. I think Conway and Paul have been sort of neck and neck in the polls for a little bit. And I'm not sure if I'd call Iglesias an apologist. He takes some pretty heterodox opinions. So that aside, one of my colleagues at the Prospect, Adam Sower, made the really good point that considering the whole Park 51 Cordova House thing over the summer, this ad was actually pretty tame, right? Like over the summer, you had a bunch of independent ads essentially accusing like Muslims of being, bad Americans, like not good American citizens, which I think. I think Chait called it Chait or Ezra Klein called it the most illiberal ad of the campaign season. Really, I think the ads opposing the Cordova House. It was Chait. I think the ads opposing the Cordova House were a lot more illiberal than this one. That said, I'm sort of uncomfortable with the idea of like criticizing a candidate for their religion or lack thereof.
I'm gonna have to plead ignorance on the Cordova House ad. Who ran it and it was this in a political race or where did this air?
As far as I can recall, these weren't ads for a particular race. They're just sort of like ads that were run during the whole controversy.
Like
pushing
on what?
Again.
I just saw them. Fox News or MSNBC or YouTube or what?
I saw them all on YouTube. I don't really have a TV or watch cable. And I'm not really sure what market they were targeted at, but I saw ads on YouTube. And those struck me as a lot more problematic than Jack Conway's ad. And again, I'm sort of,
this is of course categorically different because this is an actual person in an actual race running for an actual office that's putting his name behind the ad.
True.
I'm just saying
that if you're making
ahead.
A claim that like, yeah, I'm just saying if you're making a claim that this is like the most illiberal ad or this is a really illiberal ad, I think like there have been more illiberal ads over the past 6 months than this one. I guess this one's noteworthy because it's You don't expect that kind of thing to come from a Democrat, frankly.
Right, but. Right. So let's back away from the statement whether or not it leads the league in illiberalness. Let's focus on a narrower question of would you have run it? Do you think this is a net positive for Conway? Or if you were head of the DSCC, you know, in charge of the Democratic brand, do you think this ad on net helps the Democrats brand, or for that matter, the progressive brand, or hurts it?
If I were making the choice of whether to run the ad, I would probably shy away from it. If only because, you know, I don't, you know, I personally am uncomfortable with making someone's religion an issue in a campaign. I'm not sure how many people actually watch ads. Like, I'm generally very skeptical of the idea that, like, campaign ads have much of an effect outside of the ripple they cause in other media, and other media forms. So, like, I'm a Virginian. A really, really good example of this is in 05 when Jerry Kilgore ran the ad against Tim Kaine, saying essentially that Tim Kaine is so liberal that he wouldn't even execute Hitler. And I'm not sure how many people actually saw the ad, but the resulting media furor over the ad, I'm sure, like, swayed, opinion. So, like, insofar that this has any effect on the Democratic brand in Kentucky, it will depend entirely upon how much the media in Kentucky picks up on it. As for nationwide, I don't know. I mean, I guess you'll find some, like, you'll find the familiar division of opinion among Democrats between those who are sort of like, you know, we're better than that, and those who are like, why not take it to them with whatever we have. I tend to find myself on that we're better than that side, but, you know, and yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not sure on the public, at least, I'm not sure how much of an effect this will have. Other, like, it all depends on how much play it gets. I would be surprised if in Kentucky it helps or hurts Conway, helps or hurt Rand. I think that race will turn far more on more parochial concerns. You know, how much does Rand Paul know Kentucky? You know, how in touch with Kentucky voters is Jack Conway?
So I want to step away from the Conway ad just for a second and talk about a very different ad, but still, I thought, to me, visually striking. I'm sure you've also seen on YouTube the Joe Manchin ad, where he has a gun, which is cool enough, and he's talking about how awesome the NRA, which is candidates still do. But then he took it to a step which I'd never seen, which is he spots up the cap and trade bill and shoots it with his gun up right where it says jobs. Did you like that one?
I thought it was really funny. I mean, I guess
I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, me neither. I guess there were some liberals who were like, I can't believe a Democrat would do that. And, like, in the broader strategic sense, right, like, it's sort of, like, disheartening that if Manchin wins his election, he will have, like, tack so far to the right for a Democrat that it's sort of, like, on the fence how much he'll join with the caucus once in the Senate. But strictly as a piece of just, like, you know, political theater or whatever, I thought the ad was pretty good. It was really it's really striking. I mean, how many candidates pull out guns and shoot pieces of legislation and ads?
That's the first one I could think of. Only one I could think of.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, if you're watching TV in West Virginia, I would think that one sticks out.
Right, no, definitely. If only, like, again, I'm really skeptical as to how much voters actually really pay attention to the substance of these things. But, I mean, you'll remember that. You'll be like, oh, Joe Manchin, he's that guy who shot that cap and trade bill.
So back to the, you know, Aqua Buddha ad. You know what? One of the things that that Matt found, actually Matt Iglesias found more interesting about the ad was the xenophobic China bashing. And this is one that's not confined just to the Aqua Buddha ad that you're seeing across the country in Democratic ads. And of course, the DNC itself is running the Chamber of Commerce ad, which includes a whole stack of Chinese currency and intones about the evils of foreign influence and foreign money. So, again, in a larger sense, you know, this would seem to cut across the kind of more internationalist progressive values, and yet the DNC is just unabashedly, you know, bashing foreigners in a very xenophobic way. And so I kind of wanted to get your reaction to that larger campaign that's not just confined to Kentucky Senate.
Right. I mean, I think it's worth noting, too, that this is sort of a bipartisan thing. I know in the 5th District of Virginia, which is where Charlottesville is, some of the ads run against Perriello have very much been, you know, one of them has Perriello talking, like, intoning about how Perriello has cost the district jobs. And then there's, like, a TV that has, like, a Chinese flag and then Perriello's face behind it, which, you know, it's also in the same vein of, like, beware the Chinese and other foreign people. But I'm with you. I'm with Iglesias on this. I meant to write a post about it a while ago because it actually really bothers me because, you know, speaking strictly from a policy matter, like, there isn't, like, competition with China isn't zero sum, right? Like, you know, trading with China can benefit.
You don't have to convince me of that. I'm a free trade guy.
So, yeah, it's not a zero-sum thing. Like, and I understand sort of the electoral gain and, like, running against, you know, the specter of China and the specter of foreign money in the campaigns. But, yeah, as a progressive, it is sort of troubling because these things – because foreigners aren't bad. Like, working or interacting with other countries in a global market isn't a bad thing. Though –
This isn't new, especially for this White House, though. I mean, you know, Obama's been hitting this, foreign repatriation tax for a while now and talking about how evil it is for American corporations to invest overseas and to bring that money home. You know, and Democrats, of course, Dick Durbin on down, have been talking about how, you know, we need to keep all this money at home. So, you know, this idea that globalization is bad is not new for the Democratic Party.
That might be like sort of true. I don't know the details of that, you know, of those ads or of that act. But I do know, you know, that a Democratic president passed NAFTA, and
that's true. Not this one. A Democratic president,
right?
But not this one.
Right. But like Obama hasn't really done anything. You know, Obama hasn't tried to pass tariffs or anything, right? Like there hasn't really been anything he's done or Democrats in Congress have done to sort of go back on the Clinton approach to the global economy.
Well, on the other hand, you know, Clinton passed NAFTA, but, you know, you haven't seen Obama lift the finger for, you know, the Korean or Colombian trade agreements. So it's not like he's been furthering free trade. And, you know, with all his he did slap imports on Chinese tires, which, you know, George Bush is also guilty of slapping import tariffs on steel. So, you know, and unfortunately, anti-globalization is often a bipartisan game. But, go ahead.
It's fair to also say, right, that like part of the, at least in the Democratic Party, part of the discomfort with globalization has purely to do with the fact that at the same time we're opening up markets and sort of like reducing the barriers for capital flow, we are gutting the social. We're gutting the social safety net. We are not really doing anything to help people on the very low end of the, you know, the income distribution. Like poor people, working class people aren't being helped by this. Like the gains may be accruing to the economy as a whole, but there isn't much in the way of redistribution to people who are being hurt by globalization. So I think, you know, insofar that Democratic complaints and liberal complaints have to do with that, I think they're totally, totally fine, totally justified.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting to see where Obama's going to go from here as far as where he's going to pivot to the right or left after the elections, because, you know, he's been putting off all of his, larger Wall Street big business friends, saying, oh, no, I'll get around to trade agreements, I'll get around to free trade and the rest of it. But he hasn't actually done anything yet. He talks about, doubling American export in 5 years. But nothing has actually happened concretely to make that happen.
I mean, my guess, right, is that in the next Congress, when his ability to maneuver with regard to sort of big legislation is totally gone, that you'll probably see some movement, either way on those things. I honestly don't know enough about the administration's policy towards its free trade acts to make any like substantive comment, but I think with a lot of things, actually, you'll see more movement in this next Congress, just because there's very little chance of anything really going through legislatively, or like anything that would be particularly liberal in Congress.
Gotcha. So leaving out the foreign angle, what do you think about the White House's attack on the chamber specifically? It just strikes me as just completely counterproductive. I mean, here you have, the Chamber of Commerce, a baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie organization, if there ever was one. And
But that's not really true.
It's not really true at all.
I hesitate to call an organization that can pump tens and tens of millions of dollars into elections a baseball, hot dog, and apple pie organization. It just sounds off. Like, the Chamber of Commerce
I'll let you go. But have you ever worked on like a campaign in a rural district, or in any political campaign?
I have.
Okay, so I mean, didn't you take your candidate? I worked for Republicans, so maybe it's different. But didn't you take your candidate to the Chamber of Commerce in each small town? You know, they have get-togethers on Friday or Thursday, whatever day of the week it is. And, it's just the local business owners in town. And you bring your candidate in. They have a nice Q&A. I mean, these are the people that are sponsoring the Little League teams in towns and cities across the country. These are the nation's small business owners. It just seems a strange, target to pick.
But I mean, there's a real difference between your local friendly neighborhood Chamber of Commerce and the large national organization that, represents some of the largest businesses in the United States and essentially devotes its lobbying to, to me, it's rent seeking, to like trying to configure policy to be as pro-business as possible, which isn't necessarily in the interest of competition or fairness. So, I kind of like the Obama administration's attacks on the Chamber of Commerce, if only because I would like to see the Chamber of Commerce's image as a wholesome, pat you in the back organization tarnished. Because on a large scale, a national scale, the Chamber of Commerce really is straightforward large businesses lobbying for their own interests, which aren't necessarily in the interest of smaller businesses, frankly. The needs of a Fortune 500 company are far different than the needs of your local whatever.
Well, I'm going to have to go ahead and agree with you there. I'm actually not a big fan of the Chamber of Commerce myself. Among my circle of conservative friends, they're known as the Chamber of Compromise. And I think that's one of the You still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay. So, Chambers, not a big, or at least before this White House attack on them, was not a favored group among the conservative movement. Michelle Malkin had a good post this week talking about, when Glenn Beck had that day where he said, I'm going to give to the Chamber of Commerce and you all should too. Michelle Malkin had a post that day detailing why She's not giving the Chamber of Commerce, and it's a bill of particulars that will ring true to conservatives like myself. The Chamber supports amnesty. The Chamber supported TARP. The Chamber supported the auto bailout. The Chamber supported the stimulus. These are all things that are good for big business, but aren't good for the rule of law. Aren't good for free markets generally. That's kind of one of the funnier aspects I've had of this is the White House attack on the Chamber has kind of rehabilitated it in conservative circles.
I mean, those I read Malkin's post, and those items I don't really have much of a problem with. TARP in the end will end up gaining money for Americans. The government's expected to turn a profit. The auto bailout. It's still a little early to say whether it was very successful or not. But it looks like GM is on its way to becoming a profitable company again. The stimulus, according to most independent analysis, has saved millions of jobs and kept the economy from going into a deeper recession. Those things don't bother me so much. Amnesty, frankly, I don't really see. I find it hard to get myself worked up about people crossing a border to, exchange work for money. So with regards to that, I'm cool with the Chamber of Commerce. It's more sort of the, I think, more insidious things, lobbying to get tax breaks and tax privileges and sort of like regulatory breaks that benefit large businesses. Those other things in a macro scale benefit us all. The things that bother me about the Chamber really are just things that benefit the most big businesses.
Yeah, I guess I just don't see the distinction. I mean, TARP benefited the big banks. The auto bailouts benefited the auto companies. Amnesty benefits big corporations that rely on immigrant labor. Each down the line, I'm just not seeing the difference between your big businesses arguing for, regulatory loopholes and the bill of particulars that Michelle Malkin puts forward.
Except for the fact
that you like those policies.
I mean, the difference, right, is that the auto bail, for instance, yes, the auto bail really helped GM, but the auto bail also kept
GM and Chrysler.
Had the automakers fail, that would have created a ripple effect throughout the what's left of the American auto industry. It would have cost thousands and thousands of jobs, hurting thousands of regular Americans, thousands of people just trying to make their way. Amnesty, which I'm just going to take as meaning like comprehensive immigration reform, so I'm going to make it easier for immigrants, undocumented immigrants, to find work in the United States. Yes, it helps businesses that hire low-wage laborers, but it also helps immigrants, again, build a life for themselves. Like, I defend these policies. It's the distinction I'm making is that there's a difference between something that is essentially rent-seeking, right? Something that's designed solely to benefit the interests of big businesses, and policies that, in their aggregate effect, benefit big businesses, but also benefit everyone else. The economy collapsing would have hurt big businesses, sure, but it would have hurt every other American. So I think that's where I'm making the difference. It's not so much.
I don't think we're gonna be able to solve whether or not TARP benefited everyone or whether or not the stimulus and amnesty benefited everyone right now. I think we can safely say that conservatives have a different view of those issues and therefore view the Chamber with suspect in much the same way the left does, but just with a different list of complaints.
I will say just really quickly as like a sort of political science-y point, this sort of demonstrates the point that whenever the president enters a debate, things become partisan, not necessarily because of the identity of the president, just like, that's what happens. If the president were to come out in favor of teddy bears, I'm sure that would become a partisan issue.
Right, right.
No, I just find that really funny.
This definitely rehabilitated the Chamber of Commerce in the eyes of the conservative movement.
Right.
But speaking of money, I thought you had an interesting take on David Brooks's column on money being irrelevant in politics. Do you want to go ahead and give us the 2-minute version of that?
Sure. Basically, so Brooks was arguing that money. I think sort of the money quote he has is money is a talisman that in the scheme of things, money doesn't actually matter that much to winning or losing an election. And I wrote a column on an aspect of this for The Prospect, but the short story is that I think Brooks's view is really narrow. Spending, right, like spending lots of money may not have a huge effect. It might be true that spending, that, you know, outspending your opponent isn't necessarily enough to win you an election. But there's more to money in politics than simply spending. Money in politics also includes fundraising, and fundraising really does matter. In my column, I made the point that, you know, a candidate who spends a lot of their own money, someone like Meg Whitman or Carly Fiorina or Linda McMahon, who has a lot of their own money to spend, isn't necessarily a stronger candidate, because part of the advantage of fundraising and raising lots of money through fundraising is that you're building connections with local interest groups, with local nonprofits. You're building connections with voters, you're getting media attention, the whole nine yards. Fundraising is another form of campaigning, and candidates who don't fundraise are candidates who are missing out on the advantages of that campaigning. And so in that sense, money does really matter. How you raise it, where you raise it from, has a big impact on your ultimate success. My main complaint with Brooks's piece was that it was really narrow and really shallow. That simply looking at one group spent X, one group spent Y, therefore money doesn't matter, doesn't actually tell you anything. And then there's also, as Glenn Greenwald noted at his blog, there are some weird factual inaccuracies in Brooks's op-ed, which were worth pointing out.
I actually liked the part of your post about raising money. I've always felt as though, just from my brief work in a campaign, that as annoying and as much of a time suck as it is to have the candidate on the phone that long, that there is a lot of value in the actual fundraisers themselves. We actually go to the events, the backyard barbecues, everything else, and they're business owners, they're people in your district that have put up $220, $50, whatever, and you're at the event and the candidate is talking to these people and they're hearing them, they're hearing their stories,
right,
and they're really learning a lot about the district. And you're right that the Meg Whitmans and the Fiornas that don't have to go to these events and glad hand these people really do miss out hearing the stories that they can then, that first educate them, but then that they can, recount on the campaign trail. And they're just not as well-rounded candidates as they otherwise would be.
Right, right.
The part I didn't like about it, though, is the part that the left complains about all these outside groups spending all this money and how evil money is. And as President Obama says, they're stealing our democracy. George Will always runs his annual column every year about how, I forget if this year he did, potato chips or chewing gum. But, he says that the American people spend more on whatever, I think it was chewing gum this year, than they do on all political ads combined, all campaigning spending combined over this entire 2-year cycle. And so it kind of puts the spending in perspective as to how much really is not being spent. And then we spend all this, hyperactive time fretting about money being spent on politics and how it influences people. But in the larger scheme of what we communicate about and what we spend money communicating about, it really is just a very, very, very small fraction of the paid communication going on in the larger society and economy.
Yeah, I'm not sure which part of my post where I was sort of worrying about the amount of money in politics, because to be honest, I actually think part of the problem is that not enough people donate to political campaigns and political parties. parties have to get money somewhere. And if it isn't the average person, if it isn't, quote unquote, the good guys, then it's going to be the bad guys. It's going to be large corporations. It's going to be, you know, very wealthy donors. And for candidates and political parties.
Well, I guess this is a good transition to our next topic, which is the Koch brothers. So what makes them so evil? You know, I read the New York Times story today. And my takeaway was, so what? What makes the Koch brothers so evil and their influence on campaigns spending and even non-campaign spending? I mean, I think they do the majority, the best of their work in non-election seasons, you know, when they're funding Cato and other organizations that generally educate the populace about limited government. Kind of more education, political education that way, as opposed to direct electioneering.
I mean, I don't know.
Well, you said you know, evil corporations and they're the bad guys. So I'm just asking, you know, who are the bad guys and what makes them bad?
I mean, what makes them bad is that like they're advocating for interests that aren't. That really aren't in the best interest of anyone. Like the Koch industries, they put money into efforts to shed doubt on the reality of global warming and human caused global warming. Things that will have a huge impact, maybe not in the United States, we're rich enough to sort of deal with the consequences of global warming, but Bangladesh isn't, Pakistan isn't. And so, you know, having extremely wealthy people and extremely wealthy corporations donate millions of dollars to efforts to move the United States away from doing something about global warming or doing its part, strikes me as, at the very least, really morally irresponsible.
Let me stop you there and ask you a question. Do you think they're doing this in bad faith? Do you think they understand that that they believe that global warming more importantly the solutions for global warming that are going on now in Capitol Hill, cap and trade, energy taxes, renewable energy standards? Do you believe that they actually think that those are good policies, but are stopping them for their own pecuniary interests? I mean, you said it's morally wrong. And so I guess I'm asking you, do you think they're acting in bad faith? Because I would point out that they're libertarians and that they believe that limited government actually does make everyone wealthier overall in the end. So do you just think they're wrong, which is perfectly fine, or do you think that they're acting in bad faith?
I mean, I don't think they're twirling their mustaches, you know, every day after they donate money to some cause that's anti-global warming action. Like, I don't think they're, you know, comical villains. But, I mean, I do think they are intensely self-interested, as businessmen tend to be.
Well, I'm not saying they're not self-interested. I'm just saying that...
Right. And what I'm saying is that I don't think it's necessary for them to be evil per se. I don't think it's necessary for them to be villains, for them to be taking actions and doing things that are morally problematic, right? Like being solely devoted to advancing your narrow parochial interest, even when those narrow parochial interests are harmful to everyone else, isn't necessarily, you know, evil. It doesn't make you evil. It just makes you, you know, short-sighted.
So what I'm hearing is that you do think they're acting in bad faith, that they are focusing just on their narrow parochial interests, and that they are not true believers in the larger vision of liberty helping everyone.
That's not bad faith, right? I mean, they can be true believers in, you know, the vision of their form of liberty helping anyone, and it could be the case, and it is the case, I think, that their vision of what liberty is wrong.
Right.
That it isn't actually helping anyone. Like, I'm not, like...
So you just think they're wrong, and it's the fact that they're wrong that makes them evil.
But I'm not saying they're evil.
No, that was your word, not mine.
When did I say they were evil?
Well, no, you're not evil, but you did call them the bad guys.
I mean, like, the bad guys, I mean, like, let me walk that back then, you know, the bad guys in the sense that you don't want people with, that it's not good for people with narrow, intensely parochial interests that, like, benefit only them to be shaping public policy. Like, bad in that sense. Not bad necessarily in them being villains or evil in any sense.
Right. Well, I mean, let me make the case that they're actually the good guys compared to most corporations. Tim Carney had a great post up today, responding to Think Progress, which published a list of attendees at a Coke event, and it listed his name as a speaker. And the point of Tim's post was to point out that, you know, he just went there and talked about what he always talked about, which is how big corporations come to Washington, D.C. to spend money on lobbyists, to lobby for their own narrow parochial interests at the cost of the common good. And he calls out some names. He says, you know, Walmart with their lobbying for the individual mandate and lobbying for a higher minimum wage, Exxon and Chevron on energy grounds, and, of course, General Electric. From cap and trade to light bulb regulation to stem cell research, there's, you know, so many things that GE has been lobbying the government for their own narrow interests. And Tim's point was that, you know, Coke is actually the opposite. And that most of the businesses there were, you know, kind of small, not smaller, but non-public corporations like that don't see Washington as a profit center like most major corporations do today. I think he's dead on. I think that's exactly too many corporations these days, in my view, are the bad guys, and they are in Washington D.C. with armies of lobbyists lobbying for their own narrow interests, and they are not looking for a more limited government that would let all businesses compete on equal footing.
I mean, see, this is going to be where we differ, right? Because I don't think there's necessarily, you know. Coke Industries, maybe lobbying for liberty or whatever, but their brand of liberty also benefits them financially. They save money if there isn't a regime pricing carbon. So I don't think that they're as
Tim's and I's response would be, if their interest was just in making money, they would be able to earn a lot more by playing the same game that Duke Energy does and all these other energy companies that are at the cap and trade table with their hands out. They own a lot of natural gas refineries, which would be a big winner under cap and trade. If they wanted to, they could, have a seat at the bargaining table, pay a bunch of politicians and lobbyists a bunch of money, and make it so that all of their energy interests came out big cap and trade winners. But they don't, because that's just not the vision of how they want their how the market should work, or how they want to win.
I mean, sure, but that's not. I mean, that doesn't mean just because they could make more money following a different path does not mean that they are not unconcerned with making money. It just means that they're concerned with making money, provided it fits within their like preferred ideological framework. I was gonna say something else, and that is, again, I want to push back against this idea that, you know, reducing government obligations to protecting the environment, to protecting consumers is necessarily inhibiting a free market. I mean, inhibiting a free market. Allowing businesses free rein to do what they want, which I think is fundamentally what Koch Industries and the Koch brothers intend, like what they want, what they desire, free rein for businesses to simply do what they want, uninhibited by government action, can lead to scenarios where the market isn't helped at all, right? Can lead to scenarios where there isn't actual competition, where single companies or single groups of companies dominate industries without, and there isn't any entry point for a competition to sort of go in and like stand its ground against the existing players. You know, I don't think Yeah, I don't think it's right to conflate limited government with free markets. Government has to man the barriers, as it were, and create the conditions for competition and markets to operate. As far as I see it, groups like the Koch brothers are trying to destroy those barriers and destroy those guidelines to come out on top. Competition be damned.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously are going to end up strongly disagreeing here. I think the Koch brothers and most conservatives would say that the government is necessary, absolutely necessary. They have to enforce contracts and define property rights. But after those two things are done, they need to stop and go home and get out of the way. And I think it's safe to say that you have a more activist view of what government should be doing in order to make sure that the market has the right outcomes.
I am a liberal.
Fair enough. Speaking of liberals, this time rich ones, George Soros just donated, what was it, $100 million?
Yeah, I think it was $1 million, something like that.
$1 million? That sounds low. Okay, we'll go with $1 million. It was a lot of money. To Media Matters, who took on the Heritage Foundation last week. After waiting for Superman, one of our education analysts had a post up pointing out that the White House was hosting an event about how important high school graduation rates were. And this was the same White House that took 216 scholarships away from D.C. school children for a program that is the best high school graduation program in the entire country. And we pointed out that after controlling for certain outcomes and the fact that people who either did or did not apply for the scholarship program got them, so you had a nice control group in the study, that a study published by the Department of Education found that there was a 20% impact for using a scholarship and attending the private school and graduation rates, and that there's few programs out there that have that differential. And Media Matters came in and said that our analyst was making up these statistics, and our analyst responded. And I credit Media Matters. They ate crow and admitted they were completely wrong on the issue.
I mean, the way I read the whole back and forth, I don't think Media Matters was accusing your analyst of making up stuff, just sort of.
No, look at the headline. Heritage Foundation analyst makes up statistics. It's right there in the headline.
Oh, well, I mean, like in the body, it sounded more like they were going after sort of like inaccuracies in reading the statistics. But, you know.
Whatever. Well, you know, who reads the headline, really?
I mean, exactly. Yeah. Point taken. You know, I think it's worth mentioning. I think it's worth noting, you know, and I think this was overlooked in a lot of the discussion of the D.C. mayoral election, that the Obama administration, while maybe not that friendly to vouchers, is certainly a fan of charter schools. It's certainly a fan of school choice in, like, a different context. In that, as far as the waiting for Superman is concerned, I think the Obama administration would probably find itself more on the side of Michelle Rhee. This sort of raises a larger point, and that is, in D.C., this was very much an intra-party discussion, and it wasn't as if liberals were taking the side of teachers' unions, who, it should be noted, aren't, you know, a single monolithic villain. Some teachers' unions.
There's actually, it's not monolithic. There's two of them. There's the American Federation of Teachers, right, and the NEA, and it was the AFT that actually funded the campaign against Fenty. Not the NEA.
Yeah, and you know, the teachers' unions in D.C. were like renegotiated a contract with the teachers' unions in D.C. that wasn't as favorable as when they had before. So I think, you know, with this, it's an intra-liberal fight. It's liberals sort of taking different approaches to school reform. B, it's not necessarily the case that liberals are opposed to school choice. They would just like it within particular contexts. And C, yeah, the unions aren't, like, all teachers' unions aren't villains. You know, in the DC election, one of the teachers unions funded the campaign against Benty. But, you know, it's interesting that, like, almost like every major group contributed to the campaign against Benty, which to me says it's less about education and more about, like, other issues with Benty and his administration.
What was the feeling in your office about the election?
I would say that a lot of us were, you know, we were supportive of Rhee's efforts, and would like to see similar things go forward, but we were skeptical of the teachers union bashing.
Skeptical of what? I'm sorry.
Skeptical of the teachers union bashing.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
So, do you think the teachers unions are net positive or negative as far as school reform goes in DC?
I honestly think it depends. It depends on if, I think it's possible, again, policy isn't a negative sum thing. And I think it's possible for you to have a positive sum outcome where kids and teachers unions benefit. It depends. If teachers unions decide that it's in their interest, and I think it is, to work to change the status quo, then there'll be a net positive. If they don't, then there'll be a net negative. But it has nothing to do with anything inherent to teachers unions, nothing to do with what they ultimately decide to do. I don't think a teacher union, you know, qua teachers union is, you know, harmful to advancing the interest of kids, but nor do I think a teachers union as a teachers union is beneficial. It's sort of, it depends.
So is there any growing realization in the left and the offices of the American Prospect that government unions like teachers unions might be a liability for the progressive movement and the Democratic Party? I'm thinking of the DC mayoral election, but I'm also thinking of a Washington Post poll this week showing that a majority of Americans believe federal workers are overpaid for the work that they do. Thinking of the fact that the majority of union workers in the country now work for the government, and that there's pension crises hitting state, local governments across the country. Is there any worry that among the progressives that the unions are too powerful within your coalition and might prevent you guys from doing some of the things you want to do?
I don't think so at all. I mean, first, unions, there are very few groups in American life that are devoted to mobilizing voters, and unions are one of them, and that undoubtedly benefits progressive aims. Unions work hard to maintain middle-class benefits, the middle-class lifestyle for their members, and again, there aren't very many forces in American life that continue to do that. As for that Washington Post poll, I read that, and, you know, and first of all, it's not true, right, that federal employees are paid more.
It is very, very true.
I mean, when you account for levels of education, federal employees aren't paid as much as their private sector counterparts.
No, that's not true. I'll let you go ahead and post what studies you have. But from what I see at TAPT and TNR, they all change the game and change it to state and local. But, please do show me what studies you have that show that the federal government workers are not overpaid compared to their private sector counterparts.
I know I've written something in the past about this. But I'm almost 100% positive that federal workers, when you account for their level of education experience, are not overpaid. But even if they were, right, even if it was the case that federal workers are overpaid compared to their private sector counterparts, the problem then isn't, you know, why are federal workers paid so much? It's why are private sector workers paid so little? Like, no one's going to make a fortune working for the government. No one goes into the government saying, I'm going to make a ton of money. I think the broader issue here is anxiety over the fact that the middle class lifestyle is increasingly unattainable for millions of Americans who work in the private sector. And I think it's honestly a little bit of resentment that they see that government workers aren't, you know, losing their pensions, taking pay cuts, and they wonder what's up, and they're angry.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they see is that when Democrats are dependent on government unions and government unions electing Democrats, and Democrats always spend more money, is that it's these federal workers that are voting themselves rich. And in the rest of the world, in the private sector, companies and employees just can't vote themselves rich. You know, they actually have to go out and work and compete, whereas government doesn't. Government's a monopoly. When government's inefficient or they pay their workers too much, all they have to do is elect more Democrats and raise taxes and have more higher spending. So I think,
again,
you know,
I don't think.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, no. So I think with the growing frustration you see among the rest of the country that aren't lucky enough to have unionized federal government jobs is that, you know, there's a real world out there and you guys aren't in it. And so I think this will be a major issue going forward for your coalition.
Again, I don't, you know, I just don't see it that way. I don't see public sector unions as being necessarily problematic for Democratic prospects, considering that they do a lot of work mobilizing Democratic voters. And again, federal workers aren't overpaid compared to their private sector counterparts, and B, it's not that they're voting in Democrats and giving themselves raises. Again, no one goes to work for the private sector, for the federal government, or state or local governments to become rich. That doesn't happen.
But they do go there to be comfortable and not have to worry about finding a new job or competition or any of those other things that the rest of
I will grant that, but like the issue isn't that federal workers are paid too much. The issue is that for the last 30 years, wages for everyone else have been stagnating, benefits for everyone else have been stagnating, and anxious people are wondering why those government workers aren't anxious, and it isn't because they are lazy or inefficient. And for my part, you know, I would want government workers to be paid well because government services ought to be delivered well, and well-paid workers deliver better services. But workers in the private sector are wondering how come I can't maintain my private sector, my middle class lifestyle, and they're going for the available target that just happens to be the wrong target.
Fair enough. Well, I think we're about 50 minutes in. I think that's a good place to end it for your maiden blogging heads voyage.
Yeah, no, this was fun.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Well, hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes.
Okay, take care of yourself. All right.
You too.